accommodate Representative Brown and have him come forward and take House Bill 2370 first, so the public hearing is open on that bill.
If it would be okay, Mr. Chair, but, I'd like to bring a couple people up that are also signed up to testify.
They're fine.
From Newport.
You may proceed.
So I've got the clearance to go ahead, right? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to have House Bill 2370 heard. Commercial fishing is often referred to as the most dangerous occupation on earth, and for good reason. It seems like we lose some vessels every year. It happens far too often. If you're in one of those boats when it goes down, your chances of surviving are not very good. The water temperature in the Pacific Ocean is in the high 40s or the low 50s, and you die of hypothermia very quickly. Most times, these boating accidents, there are no survivors, and the bodies are not recovered. It's a terrible tragedy for the crew and for the surviving families. Because there are no bodies to be recovered, it takes a long time to get death certificates and to wrap up their last affairs. These people are most often the wage earners and the providers for those families that are left on shore. Without a death certificate, those families lose the ability to access the benefits that they need to live. As it is now, they could be waiting for months to get that final death certificate. These people are not going to come walking back out of the sea. And if you're not in a survival gear and not rescued within a few minutes, a few minutes of going into the sea, you're absolutely history. And I thank you again for giving me the opportunity to hear this bill, and all these folks that are with me, give you some better understanding of the situation.
Thank you. Next, would you state your name and occupation for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Michelle Longo-Etter, and members of the committee. I am a fisherman's wife from Newport, Oregon. My husband, Bob Etter, is a commercial fisherman and has been for 30 years. We fish for Dungeness crab primarily, as well as for sablefish, halibut, tuna, pink shrimp, and salmon fisheries as well. Up until December of 2001, my husband and I owned and operated the fishing vessel Michelle and also the fishing vessel Nasika. The Nasika went to sea on December 11th, 2001, and it was skippered by our skipper Rob Thompson, another experienced fisherman, and three crew members, Jared Hamrick, Steve Langlott, and our son, Ben Etter. There was an accident that day due to weather and other circumstances beyond their control. The vessel capsized at about 10 o'clock that morning, and it was just simply offshore in front of our home. There were extensive Coast Guard rescue efforts, as I described in our written testimony that was submitted. The Coast Guard searched throughout the day through the evening, with both helicopters and three lifeboats, two from the Aquinnah Bay Station and one from the Depot Bay Station. During that time, other local crab boats also assisted in the search, as well as my husband, who was aboard our other vessel, the Michelle Ann, also came to assist in the search, as well as a private helicopter. The search efforts extended until the next morning, at which time the Coast Guard called off the search, and as noted in one of the exhibits that I submitted to my testimony, the likelihood of anyone surviving in those waters at 50-degree waters for more than 4 hours is simply not going to happen. The vessel itself washed up on the beach the next morning There was no sign of any of the crew members. During that period of time, one of the rescue swimmers from the Coast Guard had gone to the vessel, had been lowered from a helicopter down to the vessel to also inspect the vessel to see if perhaps someone was trapped inside of it, and there was not. Nobody was recovered. None of the bodies were recovered, and everyone was presumed to be dead. A couple of months after the incident, I made application to the medical examiner's office for a death certificate, as my husband was the personal representative for our son's estate. And in order to be able to conclude his affairs, it was necessary to have a death certificate. Our family, if you can say this, was relatively fortunate to the extent that there wasn't anyone else who was dependent on my son's income or assets for their support or survival. And that was not the case with the other families involved. Rob Thompson was a husband and a father of three children. His wife worked part-time outside the home, but he provided an income in the range of $40,000 to $60,000 a year. That family was then without any income. But for the wife's part-time work, they were dependent and in need of Social Security benefits. Steve Langlack was engaged, was a father of three children. The mothers of those children were unable to get Social Security benefits until they received a death certificate. The other young man, Jared Hamrick, did not have other people dependent on him, although the inability to have a death certificate quickly was indeed hampered their situation as well. In order to apply for Social Security benefits, many of you may be familiar that you do indeed, the first thing that they list is you have to have a death certificate. One of the families, Trish Thompson, was unable to get a death certificate promptly, and as a result, she spent almost over a year trying to get Social Security to allow her to rely on Coast Guard reports and or newspaper articles of the loss unsuccessfully, and she did not begin to receive Social Security benefits for 14 months after the accident. I'm not saying that that's the responsibility of the state medical examiner's office. And I'm also not here today to complain as about the state medical examiner's office. The reason I'm here today, although my circumstance and interaction with them was less than helpful, I might point out to you that 2.5 months after I called the state medical examiner's office asking, you know, for the death certificate, I waited that long of a period of time that I was told that it would be another 3 months before it would be issued. And that was because, after all, he might turn up. To be a family that has suffered that kind of loss where no body is recovered, as well as a catastrophic incident in which many families and an entire community is affected, was hard enough. But it pointed out to me very clearly that our own medical examiner's office, and indeed perhaps, you know, much of the community outside the fishing community, was not really familiar with what happened when a vessel was lost at sea and bodies were not recovered. And this is what spurred my interest. I think the medical examiner's office has a difficult job, and I recognize that there are some circumstances in which when bodies are not recovered that there may be some question as to where they are. This was not the case. I had submitted to them a copy from the Internet of a press release that documented the Coast Guard effort search, the fact that the search had been abandoned, that no bodies had been recovered, and that the likelihood of their survival was in 50-degree water was the reason for the suspension of the search. But I was then told it would take at least another 3 months before the certificate would be issued, as I mentioned, because after all, he might as well turn up. For me, I was not dependent. Our family was not dependent on my son, but the other families were dependent on the ability to obtain that death certificate. With the assistance of Representative Brown, we requested that legislation be introduced to address this issue, and I've reviewed the statute. To help this committee, I would also like to tell you about a form that is required by the Coast Guard to be filed by the vessel owner in the event of a marine accident, injury, or death. It is the Coast Guard form, what's known as CG-2692, Report of Marine Accident, Injury, or Death. And it is a form that is required by the Coast Guard to be filed in every incident of accident, injury, or death. The vessel owner must file it, and must file it within, I know it's a time frame of less than 30 days after the incident, and I think it may be, in fact, as soon as within 48 hours of the incident. It requires extensive, detailed information about the vessel, the identification of the vessel, the names and of the owners, the master, the people in charge, specific more than 20 questions about the actual incident itself, the cause of the casualty, people who were missing, injured, dead, information as to the weather, the circumstances, further information specifically detailed about the person's experience in the industry, the type of accident, and a lengthy description of the casualty. This is an accident information report that is required to be filed with the Coast Guard. They review it, they identify an apparent cause, and they sign it and approve it as well. With this type of information being required by the Coast Guard to be filed in the event of a marine accident or injury or death, I think that this is something that the committee could perhaps incorporate into the statute as being required to be filed, and that once it is filed in the event of missing people who are not recovered, that would then be able to allow the medical examiner's office to issue the death certificate so that the families of our Oregon fishing families would not again run into a situation where their ability to support the families after the loss so that this didn't happen again. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I thank you for the opportunity to testify here before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Fine. I think what I'll do is have the next witness testify, and then we'll open the panel up for questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Excuse me. I'll be very brief. My name is Ginny Goblerge. From P.O. Box 9, Otter Rock, Oregon. I am with the Newport Fishermen's Wives Association. I've been president for many years, and I've been with the association for 20-some years. Our primary purpose is to provide support to families in times of need, especially when there's been an accident at sea. I was with Michelle and the other families during the search operation for the Nasika. We were at the Coast Guard station for a day and a half. At the end of that, when the chief from North Bend Station came up to call off the search, he personally spoke with the families excuse me, and said that he would be signing the paperwork which would allow them to obtain death certificates. I'm assuming it's probably this report of accident, and my point is that the Coast Guard has been under the assumption that that was the standard procedure, that the families were able to get death certificates. None of us had any idea how much trouble that would be. Other families have since had the same experience. So I'm just kind of reemphasizing what Michelle is saying, that there is a real need here. Fishing families are all small family business owners. They're not employees. They don't have a company behind them that is going to carry on a payroll for a certain amount of time. I used to work for the university, and there are all kinds of benefits there. They don't have any benefits. They don't have any safety nets. They're small business owners. So when an accident like this happens, a family is left in immediate need, which is part of what Newport Fishermen's Wives does. We provide short-term support, like a couple weeks, help with funeral expenses and that kind of thing. 6 months to a year is way beyond our capability as a nonprofit fundraising organization to help a family get through this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'm sure for myself and the committee, we sympathize with your losses and all the losses at sea that occur. It just seems inevitable sometimes. And I know the committee is going to be resolved to solve this problem, but let me just point out a couple of issues so we know how we're going to proceed. I did get some information from the Coast Guard regarding the filing of reports, and as you'll note, the bill that you propose would require the medical examiner to issue a death certificate within 30 days after an official report of the United States Coast Guard. I don't have too many extras of these. I want to give this to you for your file because there's some problems we have to work out. I did find the form designation that you mentioned in this regulation, but I want to call your attention to the highlighted material on my second page. I'll give this to you, which states generally that a casualty investigation should be completed and submitted by the Coast Guard no later than 6 months after the date of the casualty. So what I'm afraid of, if that applies, this is giving the Coast Guard 6 months to comply, and the statute gives them 30 days, medical examiner 30 days thereafter. We might be out more time than we're thinking about. So,
well, Mr. Chair, sure I have a question.
Get this, thank you.
I have a question, too.
So I'm just posing that as a problem. May I respond to that? Excuse me?
May I respond to that?
Sure.
I think I understand. I've worked with the Coast Guard for many years on vessel safety issues and doing training for fishermen and that kind of thing. I think the six-month report is indeed the final official report, finding a fact, what caused the accident, that kind of thing. It's not a determination of whether or not anybody lived through it and if they're alive someplace and just, you know what I mean? Like, within a day, you'll know whether there are any survivors, as opposed to 6 months, it might take that long to actually investigate, find out what caused the accident.
I understand. I want to make sure it's clear that the Act doesn't do something for you that you don't want it to do.
Right.
So we're going to proceed through the rest of the questioning here of you, the rest of the members of the panel, and proceed through the public hearing. We'll not vote on this bill out today. We'll try to form a group that can work out some of the problems as the testimony develops. Questions from other members? Chair Krieger?
Mr. Chair, I'm really glad to see this thing come forward. I always refer to my prior life. And, as a game enforcement officer of some 28 years, I think if I go back and think, there was something in the neighborhood to 10 to 15 of my commercial fishermen that never came back. I knew those people personally in my community, their families, went to school with them. This is a long overdue issue that needs to be addressed, and we are going to address it. We will get a bill out, and it will pass the floor. Now, that will happen, I can guarantee you. Now, the question is whether or not we have to be connected to some six-month requirement of the Coast Guard. I'd like to go back and take a look at this accident incident report and use that as the basis after 30 days or some, like you're saying, a work group to work out the wording to make sure that we get this thing taken care of in a manner that gets these funds that these families and the children need to exist. I can recall just recently Mr. Tyson, one of my people in Bandon, just about a little over a year ago, he's missing. He hasn't shown up. I do not know of one commercial fisherman ever since I lived in Seaside from 1944 until now that showed up later. They don't come back. So we need to fix this, and I look forward to the work group you put together. I'd like to be part of that.
Thank you. Other statements or questions from the committee? Representative Gerard?
Ms. Elder, thank you. This has to be difficult for you, and we appreciate your coming and sharing your tragedy with us. I was wondering how you selected the 30 days. On the medical examiner.
There is a window of time, I think, that I looked at in terms of how much support a family can get from a community in regard to resources such as Ms. Goblish mentioned, such as Newport Fishermen's Wives. We have some emergency relief funds The Oregon Dungeness Crab Association has a crabbers relief fund that is statewide. But there is a relatively small window of time in which the community can continue to contribute to support a family in need. The 30-day period seemed to me to be a reasonable period of time in which, and again, I agree with the chair that we don't want to create ourselves the problem that if we wait for the official Coast Guard report, in the case of the Nasika, that was almost 24 months before that was filed. So that language does need to be changed. But upon receipt of the report of the marine accident, injury, or death, if someone filed a false one, they could be prosecuted for perjury. So there's a lot of emphasis on the fact that this is going to be a report that could be relied upon. The 30-day window would be able to say to the medical examiners, here's the report, here's other substantiating documents that you require, such as sometimes they require a newspaper article or a different report, that looking at an official Coast Guard report, looking at some independent verification of it, such as they require, that would be ample time in which it's for them to be able to issue the death certificate. I have to say, Representative, is it Gerard or Gerard? I'm sorry.
It's Gerard.
Gerard, that as someone who comes from private industry and private practice as well, it's hard for me to believe that a state agency wouldn't be able to review a file within 30 days and make a determination, just from the perspective of, perhaps it's my expectation of how government in a reasonably efficient manner should work. And so if 30 days is perceived to be too short a time for the medical examiner's office based upon a workload issue, I'm sympathetic to that, but it was hard as a citizen to, on my first call, I filed the request, waited 2 weeks, that's my, for a follow-up, just to make sure everything was in order. And then to be told, we won't even touch the file for 5 weeks. And then it will be 3 months after that. That's, to me, as a public agency, it felt to me that there was something wrong there, that it would, given the substantiation that I had provided, that there appeared to have been some kind of breakdown within their agency. And so I think sometimes when agencies are not responsive, that the only way to change that is to put language that says shall in the enabling legislation to require the agencies to be responsive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you. Representative Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, actually my question and perhaps concern is addressed to you in regard to the Coast Guard materials provided here and the highlighted information about submission of investigative reports. If we go back to 1B, report of investigation, the report of investigation means the narrative report consisting of findings of fact, conclusions, and recommendations, and the letter of transmittal or the form CG-2692. Number C, or letter C there, complete record, the term completed record means the narrative report and all evidentiary materials, testimony, statements, exhibits, the precept, comma, form CG-2692, attachments, etc. Then submission of investigative records at E, report of casualty investigations should be completed and submitted to commandant no later than 6 months after the date of the casualty. It would appear that CG-2692 is not the same thing as investigative reports, which are required within 6 months. And then if you hop back over to the last page regarding letters of presumed death, in most cases the report of a marine casualty involving missing persons should be completed in a timely manner. So that would be referring, I would think, to 2692 and not bound by the 6 month period for completion or submission of the entire record. So it would seem that we have some room to work to accommodate and set a timely period for submission of a death certificate on the submission of the CG 2692.
Thank you. I think your observations are very astute, and we're also dealing with a series of federal regulations here, which we could start arguing about forever, and I think the mission of the work group that we could assemble to find a triggering event for the 30 or 60 or 90 day period, which is very well documented without question, so we're all on the same page. At least that's, I think, the best way to approach the issue.
Mr. Chair.
Other questions from members of the committee, Representative?
One further comment, and if we're dealing with those federal records and the U.S. Coast Guard and their requirements here, it would appear that perhaps these have been in place for about 30 years, because they are talking about carbon copies from typewriters and steno preparations, so they might want to take a look to update their entire process.
That's a good idea. Okay. Further questions of this panel? We thank you. We have two witnesses coming up that from the medical examiner's office, I think, that would like to testify. We'd like to hear their side, and then we will conclude the public hearing and form a work group.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would ask that, if possible, I'd be included in that work group or allowed to sit in the If possible. Thank you.
We love volunteers, Representative. Thank you. You have to just come forward and be seated, and if you have materials, I will distribute them for you.
Good morning. Representative Ackerman and representatives on the committee. My name is Glenn Chastain. I'm with the State Police. I'm our Legislative Affairs Coordinator, and with me today is Dr. Karn Gunson, the State Medical Examiner, and she's going to present to you some of the concerns that we have with the current language that is in this bill.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, and representatives, for listening to my testimony. My name is Dr. Karn Gunson. I'm a forensic pathologist, and I'm a state medical examiner here in Oregon. As a state medical examiner, I am in charge of investigating violent and unusual deaths throughout the state. That would include homicides, suicides, accidents, drug overdoses, deaths in state custody, death on the job, and death of people who died not under the care of a physician. To that end, I have three medical examiners who assist me, one forensic administrator, and two medical transcriptionists. We do about 1,000 autopsies every year at our office in Portland, and we also, of course, testify in court, and we also conduct training programs throughout the state. As Ms. Etter has stated, one of my responsibilities is to certify deaths of people who are not recovered or where bodies are not found. And that's included in ORS 146, which is the medical examiner's law, specifically 146.045, paragraph 3G. That particular paragraph requires that the state medical examiner, and I'm quoting here, the state medical examiner may, after a reasonable and thorough investigation, complete and file a death certificate for a person whose body is not found. House Bill 2370 does conflict somewhat with that, because it requires that I only rely on one piece of information, which would be the Coast Guard information. I may have information from other sources that provide other information, but I cannot rely on that according to House Bill 2370. So the language as it is written would constrain my ability to do a reasonable and thorough investigation as required by ORS 146. The 30-day time frame is somewhat short given the fact of our personnel issues that we have at the office. However, I am committed to providing these death certificates in a very timely fashion. I understand what Ms. Etter has said about their problems in not receiving a death certificate. So I'm committed to a timely perusal of the information and issuing of death certificate in these cases. I am very concerned about it, issuing death certificates when bodies are not recovered, because a death certificate is a very important and valuable document which can be used for a number of nefarious schemes, including fraud and possibly even identity theft, that kind of stuff. And certainly I'm not suggesting that would occur in Ms. Etter's case, but that overall is why I'm so concerned about issuing a death certificate, not only in a timely fashion, but after a complete and thorough investigation, such as I would do currently. I am committed to helping you in your work group if you so desire. I would love to work on this particular language and arrive at a bill which would be satisfactory to Ms. Etter, Representative Krieger, and Representative Brown. Thank you so much for allowing me to testify, Chairman Ackerman, and committee members. I would be glad to answer any questions that I can.
Okay. Committee questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Dr. Gunson. Your statement is that you would be committed, or you would be precluded from conducting an investigation based on the information from the Coast Guard, as I understood you. What type of investigation would you be conducting based upon a report from the Coast Guard of a presumptive death?
Chairman Ackerman, Representative Flores, the way that the language states now is that I am required to file a death certificate within 30 days upon receipt of simply the Coast Guard information. I cannot take into account, according to House Bill 2370, any other information that I may receive, such as information that Oregon State Police might provide to me, or the sheriff, or anybody else. So I am concerned that I am not allowed to take into consideration other information that may come my way during that 30-day period. In other words, in the worst-case scenario, and I'm not suggesting at all that this would have happened in Ms. Etter's case, in the worst-case scenario, I could receive from the Coast Guard the official report that a certain person was on the ship, but I receive from the sheriff confirmation that this person may have been elsewhere, may not have been on the ship. So in the worst case scenario, if you stretch the language, I would be signing a death certificate, or required to sign a death certificate, who I might have reason to believe is still alive.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Gerard.
Good morning, Ms. Gunson. excuse me. What would be a reasonable time, in your opinion, to conduct this investigation?
Chairman Ackerman and Representative Gerard, I'm looking at somewhere around 60 days or so as a reasonable amount of time, given my own personnel constraints and the fact that I myself and my forensic administrator are the two people who review these reports, and that would be in receipt, after receipt of all the information that the family would provide, including the Coast Guard records. I'm certainly willing to have this discussion about what everybody would consider a reasonable length of time, but in my opinion, that would be.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Further questions from the committee? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Gunson, I recognize that you need to make sure you've made a thorough and scientific evaluation of the information that comes before you. I think one of the key issues here, though, is at what point is what significance should be given to the Coast Guard report as opposed to other information, and what should be the then triggering the timeline that you need in order to do the appropriate kind of evaluation. One suggestion that had been aired earlier was to rely on the ship owner's report about an incident, rather than waiting for the Coast Guard report, which sounds like it could be delayed up to a number of months. How do you feel at this point about acting on that information, which doesn't require then all the processing that the Coast Guard would go through before then you would proceed with your the 60 days that you need to evaluate?
Chair Ackerman and Representative McPherson, I thought that was an excellent idea that Ms. Etter brought forward with the report that would be filed by the boat owner. Plus, as you saw in some of the Coast Guard regulations, the Coast Guard can issue a letter stating that the person is missing and presumed drowned. That is part of their procedure. And as I understand it, Representative Flores was pointing out, this may come earlier, though I haven't read that extremely carefully, than the final report. So perhaps what would happen is that upon receipt of information from the family, which we require because we don't have any investigators in our office. We would ask that the family provide that information, the boat owner's report, or perhaps the letter from the Coast Guard, plus other supporting information, as Ms. Etter had pointed out. Sometimes these would be newspaper articles. Sometimes they would be sheriff's reports. Present that to us. That would trigger the timeline. Once we receive that in our office, that would trigger our timeline for evaluation. And within a certain period of time, we would then issue the report, or our death certificate, I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions for the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Chair, question.
I do.
Okay. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Gunson, how many marine accidents and vessel capsizing events does the medical examiner's office handle in a year?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Flores, very few.
Very few.
Very few, but we have a number of other requests for death certificates on bodies that are not recovered that do not involve a marine accident, that involve other accidents or disappearances.
Follow up.
You may.
Because of the sensitive nature of timing for marine accidents specifically, would it not be reasonable to request, require, or presume that your office could prioritize some level of handling for this type of incident so that the affected parties could receive a death certificate?
Yes, ma'am. I think that would be a reasonable thing to do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions from the committee?
Representative Flores asked my question, so.
Okay. Good question. Hearing no further questions, then we'll take our last witness, and you may be excused for the moment. And I thank you for bringing up all these alternatives, because I can see that we're going to come to a good conclusion on this one.
Thank you, Chairman.
Okay, I have Warren Darris, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Warren Darris. I'm an attorney in private practice in Oregon. I'm actually here to testify on another bill. But hearing the testimony I just heard, I realize this is part of a larger problem on which I promised to get a draft to Bill Taylor to deal. And that's in the area of estate planning and probate, administering the estates of missing persons. This problem has arisen in connection with those who died in the tsunami, who came from Oregon, and of course we don't have to worry about Oregon death certificates for them, but we've had a couple of major events, 9/11 and the tsunami, in which people from Oregon have died outside of Oregon, and they have exposed, as we try to deal with administration of the estates of these missing folks, a gap in Oregon law. And if you have a work group working on this, I think this is something you need to take into consideration. There is, under Oregon law, no way to administer the property of somebody who is merely missing. For a conservatorship, you have to have personal service on the respondent. And, of course, you can't have personal service on someone who is missing. ORS Chapter 117 governs administration of the estates of absentees. And you cannot, in Oregon, file an absentee proceeding until the person has been missing for a full year. And there needs to be a correction there. We need to be able to initiate an absentee proceeding when somebody is missing for a much shorter period of time and have a vehicle available to manage the property of these folks. In addition to the concerns that you heard today about being able to file for Social Security benefits, things for which you need a death certificate. And by the way, to probate a small estate in Oregon, you have to attach a certified death certificate. So again, this is a broader issue than merely the issuance of a death certificate. I do plan to have some draft language to Bill Taylor to deal with this other issue, and possibly it's something that could fold into this bill. Possibly we need a separate bill that might be considered by your work group on this general subject. And I just might say that I do work for the Department of State Lands and Escheat Estates. We had a recent case in Elkton where an elderly gentleman living in a rural area disappeared, And that's where we ran into the statutory problem of no way to administer the estate. It was months before his body was finally found just a week or two ago to allow administration of the estate to go forward. But because of this gap in the law, there was nothing we could do.
Fine, thank you. Questions of Mr. Darris from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
This is more just for my own education, but you alluded to there it not being Oregon's issue when an Oregonian is missing in a natural disaster out of state or out of country.
Well, the death certificate.
Whose responsibility, who issues the death certificate? Does every nation issue death certificates on people who are within its borders and who are presumed missing in a disaster?
I believe the State Department has a procedure for deaths overseas. Of course, in the 9/11 disaster, it was New York's problem to issue the death certificates for those who were missing in the World Trade Center buildings.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions for the committee? Representative Girard?
If you had a boating accident, is it what determines whether it's in the state of Oregon if you're out on the ocean? Is that the... If you can answer that for me.
Frankly, I don't know. The issue from the probate perspective is where the property is that needs to be administered, regardless of where the death occurred. Now, for the Oregonians who died in the tsunami, administration of their property in Oregon is something that can and should be addressed in Chapter 117, the estate absentees. This other issue of jurisdiction to issue death certificates when a death occurs outside the boundaries of Oregon is frankly an area of law in which I'm just not familiar.
Quick follow-up?
Yes, please.
Where would you and again I'm asking, you're saying you can't give me the answer, but I'm still poking away here. If you had an accident at sea and the exact area of the loss could not be determined, who takes jurisdiction in that?
Again, it's an issue I've simply never dealt with.
Okay, thank you very much.
I don't know the answer, but again, I suspect you're looking at the State Department or some federal agency once you get beyond Oregon's jurisdiction and beyond the jurisdiction of any other state. Columbia River, we might be fighting with Washington as to who issues the death certificate.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay, Harry Dunn, thank you for your testimony. I think we're at the point now where the work group will be formed. Chair Krieger can head that. We have Representative Brown has volunteered. The witnesses on the favor of the bill will be in participation, as will the medical examiner and any others. So what I'll do is conclude the public hearing, but actually just hold it open by recess, and so we'll take it up again when the work group comes back and see if we need any public testimony. If not, we can proceed to a work session at that time. For the purposes of this morning, the public hearing on this bill is in recess pending the work group report. I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bills 2304 and 2305 since they involve common issues and I think the same witnesses. I'll ask counsel to explain the bills as Mr. Marquis is coming forward.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2304 was pre-session filed at the request of the Oregon Collectors Association. It increases the fee from $4 to $7 that a circuit court may charge for issuing writs of execution and writs of garnishment. Accordingly, this bill increases the amount from $4 to $7 that plaintiffs may recover for fees paid to an attorney for issuing writs of garnishment. House Bill 2305 was pre-session filed also at the request of the Oregon Collectors Association.
They need that.
It allows sole proprietors to designate an individual to accept writs of garnishment. Apparently, the purpose of this bill is to ensure that delivery requirements for sole proprietorships and partnerships are uniform. It's my understanding that there's an LC that LC is drafting an amendment to that effect.
Thank you, Mr. Markey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Chair Krieger. After listening to Mrs. Etter's testimony this morning, these bills seem somewhat inconsequential, but House Bill 4 is a fairly straightforward bill, and I've submitted some written testimony. When a creditor obtains a judgment and intends to execute against the judgment by garnishment, the first step is to have the garnishment issued, and either a court, circuit court, may issue the garnishment, or the creditor may choose to have an attorney issue the writ of garnishment. The court charges $4 under current law for issuance of the writ, and that $4 is recoverable as a post-judgment cost, if you will. If an attorney issues the writ, the attorney may charge anything they want to issue the writ, and the same $4 would be recoverable. This bill simply raises the $4 to $7 for both the court fee, which would be recoverable, and the amount that could be recovered from an attorney if the attorney issued the writ. A couple of reasons. We have, these fees have remained parallel so that with an attorney or a court should be the same in terms of recoverability. Unfortunately, as you know, the courts have been somewhat underfunded. They've had to stop doing some of the duties that they normally perform for businesses and other folks. And issuing these writs of garnishment sometimes is kind of at the bottom of the list and the first to go. And they actually did quit issuing writs of garnishment at one point about 3 years ago, which created some difficulties for those businesses that relied on that service. And we're hopeful that by raising the fee a little bit for them, even though the money does accrue to the general fund, we're hopeful that then the Ways and Means Committee would send that back to them, and this would encourage them to keep issuing those writs in times of dire straits. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions on that bill.
Questions of Mr. Markey? So the net effect is, Representative McPherson.
How did you arrive at the $7 figure? I mean, it seems like an odd number, in moving from the increment from $4, and it's kind of not a very round number in itself, so just curious.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I think this was done by a committee. Would that explain it?
Say no more.
Further questions of Mr. Markey? So the net effect of this is $3, is that correct?
That's right.
So you're in the position of giving us a $3 bill today, right?
Exactly, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Exactly.
Mr. Markey, you want to proceed to...
Yes, I'll move on to House Bill 2305, with your permission, Mr. Chair. Once a garnishment is issued, as I explained in 2304, either by an attorney or by the court, then the creditor, the next step in the process of garnishment is that the creditor has the garnishment delivered either by the sheriff or by a private process server to the usually place of business where the property is to be garnished. This would be to a financial institution if a bank account were to be garnished, or to a place of employment of the debtor if it was a wage garnishment, which these would be the two most common types of garnishment. The method for delivery of a writ is different in the statute depending upon what kind of business the writ is being delivered to. And I sat on a work group for about 3 years with the Oregon Law Commission on judgments and garnishments, and our work group rewrote the judgment law and the garnishment law, and did some amendments in this area. Unfortunately, I believe that the law as it exists works very well for financial institutions. If you're delivering a writ to a financial institution, generally it's delivered to a person designated by the financial institution, and that works fine for financial institutions, and it works fine for process servers and creditors. If it's a corporation, the writ gets delivered to an officer of the corporation, the registered agent, or a person designated by the corporation. That works well for corporations and larger types of businesses. When we get to sole proprietors and partnerships, they are treated somewhat differently in the statute now. And our attempt here in 2305, and I do have some amendments being drafted that will help conform this bill more properly, and I'm sorry that they weren't ready today. Our attempt is to make delivery of a writ to a business of a sole proprietor or a partnership parallel or the same. Oftentimes, it is difficult for a creditor to determine if a business is a partnership or a sole proprietorship, and oftentimes the process server then wouldn't know if it was a sole proprietor or a partnership. The requirements for delivery are somewhat different, not extremely different, but somewhat different in the statute. So, and under for a sole proprietor, the current law says you must deliver it to the sole proprietor, or in the alternative, if the sole proprietor has a place of business, an office, you may choose to deliver the writ to the person apparently in charge. And if you do, this is known as office service, and if you choose to do that, you follow the delivery with a mailing to the sole proprietor so that there's some assurance that the sole proprietor had full knowledge of the delivery of the writ. With respect to a partnership, you must serve one of the partners, or alternatively, you may serve a person designated by one of the partners to receive such documents. So, with a sole proprietor, there is no provision under the current law to allow a sole proprietor to simply designate someone to receive such documents, and the bill as written adds that provision. We would also like, in our amendments that hopefully will be drafted soon, to add this office service to partnerships. Once we do that, so that then we would be for a sole proprietor or a partnership, the process server would be able to deliver the writ either to the sole proprietor or a partner, to a person designated by one of those folks, or alternatively to provide for this office service by delivering the writ to a person apparently in charge and then following that with a mailing. And so that's what we're attempting to do, so that we just to simplify the life of creditors and process servers and all those folks that unfortunately have to deal with this from time to time. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, questions from the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Marquis, how does the process server know in either under the existing law when it's a partnership and there's a person designated, or under this proposed change, know that a particular individual has been designated? Is it because there's a routine of going to that place of business and so it's been established in the past that it's that's the designated person, or is it on inquiry? How does that happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, with respect to, for instance, financial institutions who use the designated person regularly, they make it well known throughout the credit community where you're supposed to deliver these things and simply let folks know. If the process server doesn't know if there's a designated person, they ask the employer or they ask the people at the place of employment, are you designated to accept such documents? And that's a simple process, and if they say yes, we are, they leave it. Now, obviously, if the person wasn't designated, there's always a defense that can be raised later that you didn't have proper delivery of the writ, and that hasn't been a problem in the past and doesn't normally come up.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Mr. Marquis, you mentioned amendments. You're talking about the dash ones to 2305.
You have them?
I have them in my file, but I don't know that they've been distributed beyond, and I don't know how they got to my file.
Well, Mr. Chair, we checked with counsel yesterday, and I thought they weren't up back to the Judiciary Committee, so I haven't seen them. So perhaps they got delivered to your office rather than the committee. If they're ready, if they're here, perhaps I'd be happy to go make copies of them or whatever we need to do, so we could move the bill today if you'd like to.
Yes, I'd like to, if it's appropriate to do that.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's the consensus that we'll proceed.
I would like to see them.
Yeah.
Not trusting? It
doesn't stop us sometimes.
How you see him?
Yeah. I need these copied and distributed, and we'll take a few minutes just to do that. And I'll wait till Mr. Marquis resumes his seat, and we'll move to work session on 2304.
Send it over and then take the other bill and then come back to these.
Yeah. Well, I'll conclude the public hearing on House Bill 2304 and move into work session on House Bill 2304. Is there a motion, please? Hearing none. The chair will move that House Bill 2304 be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with consideration for the consent calendar, since it's a $3 issue. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I think any kind of a fee increase,
yes,
might have questions involved. I'm just questioning the consent calendar.
Okay, well, it takes unanimous to do that anyway, so I'll withdraw the consent calendar recommendation and let the full committee deal with it. Further discussion on the motion on 2304. Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Thank you. Before I answer, Mr. Chair, for clarification, this is moving us to the full committee.
Correct.
Well, thank you very much.
Aye.
Representative Farrar?
Aye.
Representative Flores, is she excused this morning, Chair?
Affirmative? Yes, excused. Aye on the vote.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. The House Bill 2304 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and the work session on that bill is concluded. And I'll move to a work session on House Bill 2305. We'll have to wait for the 0-1 amendments, I guess.
Oh.
Yeah, we can sort it out. Yeah, give me the next bill, 2014. While we're waiting, I think we'll start with the public hearing on House Bill 2314. And we have two witnesses signed up on the sheet, Mr. Darris and Janine Holman. If you both come forward, please, we'll start that process. If you wouldn't mind just taking your seats there, and I will just recess the public hearing on House Bill 2314 so you can take Mr. Marquis's issue and move to a work session on House Bill 2305. The -1 amendments have been distributed. Do you have any comments on those, Mr. Marquis, or was that in your form of testimony?
After a very thorough analysis, Representative Ackerman, I think they're fine.
All right. A discussion on the -1 amendments?
Mr. Chair, we're just getting them.
Okay.
Thank you.
run through these and explain what they
do? Yes, why don't you do that?
Mr.
I didn't
Chair.
Know if you incorporated that in your original testimony or not.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
go ahead, you
members of the subcommittee, the amendments would allow the delivery of a writ of garnishment by removing and replacing lines 7 through 23 with the new language, would allow the delivery of a writ for a sole proprietor to the sole proprietor, if a partnership to the partner, one of the partners, additionally for a sole proprietor or a partner to a person designated by the sole proprietor or partner, and then for either a sole proprietor or partnership, office service would be allowed on page 2 after line 25. The new language would allow this writ to be delivered to a person apparently in charge, followed by a mailing to the sole proprietor or the partner. And so with that, partnerships and sole proprietors would be treated the same for purposes of delivery of writs.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Ready to proceed to vote on the amendment. Anybody need more time to consider the dash one amendment? The chair will move then that the dash one amendments be incorporated within House Bill 2305. Discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, then the dash one amendments are incorporated within the within House Bill 2305. I need a motion on the forwarding of this bill to the full committee as amended.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Girard.
I would move House Bill 2305 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Worth excused. Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
House Bill 2035, as amended, is forwarded to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. Representative Girard can be the carrier on that one, and I'll be the carrier on House Bill 2304, which we previously passed. I'll reconvene the public hearing on House Bill 2314 and ask you witnesses to resume their positions, please. Vote in favor of the bill. You can choose whom you wish to go first.
Definitely.
Darris?
Good morning again. My name's Warren Darris. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. I have to begin with some disclaimers. I'm a longtime member of both the estate planning and administration section and the elder law section of the Oregon State Bar, and past legislative chair for one of those sessions. I can't speak on behalf of either of those sections because they have taken opposite positions on the bill last year, and under bar rules, nobody can testify on behalf of the bar when sections take opposite positions on a bill. I am under contract with the Oregon Department of Justice, a special assistant attorney general. I do the SG probate work for the Oregon Department of State Lands. But I do not testify today on behalf of either the Department of Justice or the Department of State Lands. This is my bill that I prepared based on my experiences largely working for the Department of State Lands, and of course I sought and obtained the approval of the Department of State Lands before submitting the bill to the legislature. In the packet, let me just give you a brief guide through the packet of materials that I've presented as part of my testimony. First, there are two sets of amendments in there. Unfortunately, I didn't have time. By the time the Legislative Council draft arrived, to review it before it got into bill form, and there were a number of problems with the LC draft that are addressed in the first set of amendments. And the first set of amendments also incorporates some changes requested by the group of the Elder Law Committee with whom I was negotiating to try to get them to change their position. The second set of amendments was requested by the staff at the Estate Administration Unit of the Department of Human Services and would make some changes to the last page of the first set of amendments to assure notice to the Estate Administration Unit in appropriate circumstances under the terms of this bill. The next item in the packet is a section-by-section analysis of the bill. In other words, it explains each change proposed to Oregon law, and it also explains each area of the bill in which I think an amendment to the bill is necessary and the reason for the proposed amendment. So that's the analytical document. I always try to do that when I have a measure before the legislature, because I think it is an important part of my responsibility to create a good legislative history of the exact intent of everything I'm doing. That way, years from now, when somebody complains about a screw-up, they'll know that they can blame me.
Can I ask just a question right here? Because the amendments that you have proposed are those which you drafted personally. They don't come from legislative councils.
That's correct. They have not gone through LC yet.
Technically, they're not before us today.
I understand that.
So we're going to need some direction. If you're going to request more time for this bill, we should know that. Or if the amendments are going to come back in the form of a new bill, we should know that.
And my plan and my understanding, talking to Mr. Sears, is that I need to get a note, what's popularly called a note from Mother, to take to LC to get the amendments drafted into proper format by legislative council.
Okay, so then you'll be speaking then to the bill, and you'll make arrangements. If you want more time on the bill, you're going to have to let us know if you're going to try to obtain some amendments. I'm just trying to straighten out procedures so I know where I'm going this morning.
Yeah, whatever procedure is appropriate to get the amendments finalized and into the bill is the procedure I want to follow.
I prefer that you speak to the merits of 2314 and leave the amendments to the time when they come back to us on proper notice from LC.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Yeah. And again, the amendments are by and large clarifying, not hugely changing in the substance of the bill. The probate departments of the courts in the state of Oregon perform many functions, but two functions are dominant, dealing with protected persons in conservatorship and guardianship proceedings. And here we're going to talk primarily about conservatorship proceedings, in which people who are unable to manage their financial affairs have a court-appointed conservator who manages those affairs for them. The second major area of operation of the probate courts is decedent's estates, managing the estates of those who die. The two types of proceedings have fundamentally different objectives. Conservatorship proceedings are designed to protect the interests of the protected person. Once the protected person dies and we move into a decedent's estate, the emphasis changes. And probate of decedent's estate is designed to protect the interest of those who have an interest in the estate. Creditors, heirs, those are the people who inherit in the absence of a will, and devisees. So we have two processes with fundamentally different objectives. Those two processes intersect when a protected person dies. And this bill is designed to deal with that intersection, because right now there is in Oregon law a fundamental lack of guidance to conservators and their attorneys on what they are supposed to do when the protected person dies. What the statute says now is that their authority ends, but they've got all these assets and they have to do something with them, and as a result of the lack of guidance, first, some things that are done that conflict with other provisions of the Oregon Revised Statutes outside of Chapter 125, the chapter that conservators focus on. And the practice of courts varies from counties to counties. In some counties, in effect, you go into a mini probate at the end of the conservatorship with the assets ultimately being distributed to heirs and devisees, but without the protections for creditors that are a necessary part of the probate process. And what I'm proposing in this bill is to give guidance to conservators on what they are supposed to do. The problems that I have experienced are primarily problems representing the Department of State Lands, because that seems to be an area in which conservators and their attorneys are most confused about what to do. What happens when a protected person dies and you don't know of a will and you don't know of any family? My experience has been that what happens is nothing for months and months and months. And at the end of my testimony, I've got four examples of an estate with which I have dealt in recent years where we have had that problem. Throughout this period, the requirement of first the Department of State Lands rules, and since January 1st of last year with the enactment of the new legislation on SG, the statutes, the requirement has been that they are supposed to give notice to the Department of State Lands within 48 hours of receiving notice of, first, there's a death, second, don't know of a will, third, don't know of heirs, and fourth, there are assets subject to probate. In the Brook estate, the first example in the sheet, we had an estate worth $500,000. We had a guardian conservator who was also a lawyer who spent hours trying to find, build the estate, hours, trying to find heirs. And finally, after more than 6 months, gave notice to the Department of State Lands. It took the Department of State Lands about half an hour to contact and identify all the heirs. They're in the business of doing that, and they're good at it. That's part of their job. It is not just to grab every penny they can for the Common School Fund. Before anything goes into the Common School Fund, they're obligated to find out if anybody is entitled to the estate. The heirs, in that case, should have gotten their inheritance 6 months earlier. Sometimes, during this kind of six-month delay period, it's in the Sassine estate, the last one on the list, where, again, we had a delay of a little over 6 months. You got a house sitting empty and deteriorating. In that case, in the Sassine case, we had the conservator and his attorney go to the court in the conservatorship proceeding, and with notice to no one, since the only one entitled to notice in the conservatorship was the protected person who was now dead, with notice to no one, get court approval for over $30,000 in fees. And one objective of the bill is to assure, because we are in agreement that it's appropriate that the conservatorship court review the appropriateness of fee requests, but one objective of the bill is to assure that when a conservator, guardian, or their attorney goes to the conservatorship court to seek approval of the court for their fees, the people who will ultimately pay the fee, those who are entitled to receive the estate, get notice so they can object. And one of the entities which is particularly concerned about getting notice is the Estate Administration Unit of the Department of Human Resources, because when they've paid out frequently six or seven figures worth of Medicaid benefits, and there's a home left in the estate that was an exempt asset under the Medicaid rules, so they're allowed to get benefits despite having a home worth a couple hundred thousand dollars, they should know if the family member is now going to try to divert all those funds to itself. So one of the objectives is to make sure under this bill that if something's going to happen in the conservatorship proceeding that is going to impose a financial burden on the probate estate, that appropriate notice goes out to the people with an interest in the probate estate. Right now, there is no process for assuring that. The other kind of notice, besides notice to heirs, devisees, the personal representative, the other kind of notice that we want to assure under this bill is in those cases, and admittedly these are rare cases, where there is no will, there is no known heir, that the Department of State Lands gets notice so that it can step in at the earliest moment before all the records have been tossed out that lead to identification of heirs, so that they can step in and search through those records and identify those who are entitled to estates. My experience with the Department of State Lands is that in 90% of the estates that are initially referred to them as likely escheats, they find a will or they find heirs. The staff has become very good, they're very experienced at walking as strangers into someone's home after they have died, usually in a very unpleasant experience. Usually, tend to be people who are isolated, and usually the body's been in the home for some time, and the food is all spoiled, and they walk into really sloppy situations, but they go in there and they find the necessary records, and they identify and locate the heirs or the devisees under the will, and they turn the property over to them at very modest cost to them. Another case I wanted to point out in this list of three is the Pugh estate. That was an estate, again, the value was around $500,000. Ms. Pugh was born in Portland in 1922. Both of her parents came from England, and they had separated from their families when they came here. Ms. Pugh had 16 aunts and uncles, the youngest of whom was born in the 1880s. And by the time we let go of the estate, we had identified 66 heirs. And we were only about two-thirds of the way through the family tree. By the way, all these people were total strangers. They were all cousins, cousins once removed, cousins twice removed. Nobody ever heard of Ethel Margaret Pugh. But, you know, that's a question of whether our scope of heirship in Oregon goes too far in allowing those people to inherit as opposed to the money going to the common school fund. But that issue aside, as a result of the delay in notice to the Department of State Lands, an independent heir searcher found out what was going on and began notifying relatives in England. So by the time we got there, most of them had already been notified, and most of them had already signed contracts with the independent heir searcher to pay 40% of their inheritance to the independent heir searcher. That's how the system works. If DSL doesn't get prompt notice, there's somebody going to be out there seeking compensation for paying these people the inheritances to which they're rightfully entitled. And so an important objective of this bill is to get prompt notice to the Department of State Lands in those few cases where the Department of State Lands has an interest. Beyond that, the basic provisions of the bill and incidentally, speaking of the Department of State Lands, as part of the initial negotiations with the bar sections that were interested, the department agreed to a change in current law with regard to notice to the department. Right now, the statute requires notice within 48 hours. In many cases, the department recognizes that 48-hour period is unrealistic. Often people don't consult with an attorney within 48 hours or can't get an appointment with an attorney if they try sometimes within 48 hours. So the standard to which the department and the State Planning Administration section of the bar agreed was promptly, but in any event, within 30 days. Again, speed is important. We want to put a cutoff point on it. but that fixed 48-hour period is probably unrealistic, and the department indicated it's willing to compromise on that issue. With regard to fees and protective proceeding, the statute makes, the bill makes a significant change. Right now, the authority of the conservatorship court to award fees ends with the protected person's death, because under the existing statute, the conservatorship court can only award fees out of the funds, the assets of the protected person. At the moment of death, under the probate code, ownership of all assets shifts to the ultimate heirs or devisees subject to administration by the probate court. In other words, under existing statute, the protected person doesn't own anything anymore. And so the statute would clarify the law to say that the court still can award the fees. It would also allow the conservator to withhold the fees out of funds distributed to the estate, to the personal representative, rather than having to distribute the funds and then get the fees back from the personal representative, in effect giving the conservator and the attorney for the conservator lien rights over to protect their right to payment of fees. The reason for giving these fees the special priority is really practical. If I'm representing a conservator and the concern arises, well, the protected person is getting near death, we don't want to lose out on our fees if he dies because we know this estate's going to be insolvent, I can go to the court and I can get a special order for a partial payment of fees to myself and my client. I can do that every month and waste a lot of time and incur a lot of additional expenses doing that. And in my view, it makes more sense to save that additional time and expense by simply assuring that those fees will get paid in the ordinary course to the extent funds are available in the probate estate after, or in the conservatorship estate after the death of the protected person. I do not recommend, and the bill does not give the conservator authority to sell assets to pay the conservator or attorney's fee in the protective proceeding, because the probate code has specific rules for what property can be sold and what property shouldn't be sold. And what I'm trying to avoid doing in this bill is effectively making the conservatorship a mini probate at the end and having to bring all of the rules of probate over to the conservatorship. It's much cleaner to end the conservatorship cleanly at the moment of death and move on expeditiously into the probate. The conservator is given some specific authority they don't have now. The conservator is given the authority to dispose of perishable property when necessary to protect the value of assets. Believe me, the Department of State Lands knows how important it is to get rid of perishable property in a house, because the value of the property, that you can walk into some real messes if nobody takes care of that. It also gives the conservator express authority to expend funds as necessary to protect the assets. In other words, you can put in a burglar alarm system if you've got a house sitting vacant, or make other arrangements for security of the property. Conservatorship court would also be given authority to resolve disputes over post-death possession of assets of the conservatorship. Because it's possible you're going to have people claiming property was jointly owned and that they should take immediately upon death. It's possible you're going to have conflicts over those kind of things. Somebody has to have the ability to immediately give the conservator guidance as to what to do with assets, because the basic concept of the bill, again, is to move the assets quickly out of the conservator's possession in the possession of successors, which may be the personal representative of the estate, which may be joint owners or payable on death owners, or which may be beneficiaries under life insurance or retirement plans. It's not at all unusual for an entire estate to pass through non-probate mechanisms. Right now, in the existing statutes, there's a direct conflict between ORS 125.530 and ORS 112.810 on what the conservator is supposed to do with a will. The conservator has an original will in the conservator's possession. Under the probate code, they either deliver it to the personal representative or they deliver it to the court with jurisdiction of the probate. Under the conservatorship code, they either deliver it to the personal representative, which is always preferable if you can find the personal representative, or they deliver it to the court with jurisdiction over the conservatorship. If the conservatorship court doesn't have jurisdiction over the probate, which is not an unusual circumstance, you have a direct conflict in the statutes there, and the bill resolves that conflict in favor of delivery to the court with probate jurisdiction. New provisions would require the conservator to give notice to those who have an interest in the estate. Right now, the conservator doesn't have to give anybody notice of the death. And again, the objective is the protected person for whom the conservatorship proceedings are designed is gone. Get the assets out of the conservatorship process over to those with a true interest in them. Get notice to those people, hey, it's time for you to step in and take over this estate. If there were no conservator, it would be up to the guardian to make that delivery.
May I ask a question?
Good question.
Mr. Darrell?
We have a question from Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Darrell, before you go too far down the road trail from that, in a conservatorship proceeding, upon the death of the one being protected, is it not a requirement of the conservatorship proceeding to file a notice of death with the court to terminate the conservatorship?
The only thing that the statute says affirmatively that the conservator has to say do, which is quoted on page 2 of my bill, is to file a final account within 30 days with the court. And by the way, I'm often omitted, not omitted, but delayed activity.
Follow up.
You may.
I'm confused. It seems to me, or I've spent a number of years dealing with estate planning, probate, and conservatorships and guardianships. And in a conservatorship, if the person dies, it seems to me, in order to terminate the conservatorship, you have to provide notice to the court.
You have to call the final account.
Okay. Follow up?
Sure.
So then your intent here is to try to smooth the path that's in the statute. Common sense says that if a person is dead and there has been somebody administering that conservatorship proceeding, that and there are assets in the estate, practice would seem to indicate that you then move to a probate proceeding. But you're trying to clarify all of that in statute. Is that what you're
trying to give very specific directions about how to do that? And again, the problem is that what has developed in some jurisdictions in practice is, frankly, to save the probate filing fee and to save some of the expenses of probate, the end of the conservatorship becomes kind of a mini but not authorized probate process in which fees get approved and assets are distributed directly to heirs or devisees. Now, very likely the conservator was a child who is an heir and wants to save the probate expenses, but unfortunately this is done in a process that doesn't protect creditors. Now, another category of people who are expressly protected in the probate process, but whose protections in the conservatorship process are pretty minimal. They don't get notice of what's going on. And again, the big creditor, the big party of interest tends to be the state of Oregon through the estate administration unit, if there's been Medicaid. And for, you know, whatever reason, in many cases children are perfectly willing for that those expenses to be recovered. But in a lot of cases, there's, shall we say, less than full enthusiasm about that happening.
One further follow-up.
Yeah,
thank you. And in regard, then, to the notice to the state administration section of State of Oregon, DHS, mm-hmm. Division of State Lands, I somehow thought there was a mechanism or a provision that that notice is required.
In probate, but not in the conservatorship. And if the probate process is effectively completed in the conservatorship, they never get notice.
And that follow-up?
Sure.
And that is required also in a small estate proceeding. So, okay, I can connect the dots. Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Darris will need to know how much more time you're going to need. We have one more witness, and I'd like to get out of here by 10:30.
Yeah, I've got nothing further.
Thank you. You have your seat. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jeanette Holman, the Assistant Director for the Department of State Lands. I have given you written testimony, and in the interest of speed, I'm just going to summarize very quickly. The Department of State Lands administers the estates of those persons who die in Oregon without heirs, without known heirs, or without a will. And it's because of that that we run into these situations where we don't get notice, as Mr. Darris has indicated. These failures to notify us have cost heirs and, in some cases, the state a fairly substantial amount of money. When we are notified, we are required within 5 days to go into the residence of the person and search for any records that would help us to find an heir or to find a will. These records are often records that are destroyed because there are things that you wouldn't think of as records that you would keep. They're greeting cards from a cousin. They're photographs, letters. And we go through those and start making phone calls to the people who sent them to the person. And that's often how we find an heir. These are the kinds of records that tend to get destroyed before we get notified of a case, which is why we need the notification as soon as possible. We actually like our 48-hour notice, but we understand, and we have, in fact, run into problems with people being able to comply with that 48-hour notice and are willing to adjust that to get the notice that Warren is proposing in his amendments. And with that, I will close and answer questions if you have any.
Questions for the committee, Representative Gerard?
Yes, ma'am. If state lands doesn't get an estate, where does it go?
If the Department of State Lands doesn't get an estate, well, sometimes it goes to the attorneys that are representing the conservator in some cases. Sometimes we don't know. It's consumed in funeral expenses. Any number.
I mean, if you had a very large estate and there were no heirs and state lands wasn't notified, what happens? It goes to an attorney?
Or a friend? I don't know. Warren, what happens to those estates?
Department of State Lands a few months ago was notified of an estate of someone who had died 5 years ago, whose home had been sitting empty and unused for 5 years. The only reason Department of State Lands got the notice was that somebody was interested in buying the home and thought and knew the role of the Department of State Lands and SG Estates and called and said, "Are you guys involved in this estate?" It lies fallow. The function, you know, the true function of the probate process is to make sure when somebody dies that the property gets wherever it's supposed to go, be that the heirs, devisees, the creditors, the Department of State Lands. When the probate process fails, it truly becomes the first person down the road who can grab the stuff.
Wow.
Who ends up taking it.
Thank you very much.
There was a case, and that may be the same one Warren was talking about not too long ago, where there was a deceased, had, I think it was a conservatorship, passed away, And the conservator didn't know what to do with the records, and they sat in the office and for, I don't know, how many years before someone asked the question, and we finally got them. It might have been the same one.
Yeah. Well, the five-year case was actually a case where there was a will, and there was an attorney who knew about the will, and there was a personal representative named in the will who knew about the will. But the will, in all frankness, left the entire estate to organizations that you would describe as gay rights organizations, and nobody was very enthusiastic about probating it, so nobody did it.
Follow?
Yes, sir.
Could anybody, if you have something that's just been sitting out there as an example, this house for 5 years, could anyone petition somebody to get that property that had no relationship to the person who died?
Well, you know, you always have the risk of squatters when you have abandoned property, no question about that. The probate process has a priority for who can petition to open a probate, and the last person in the list of priorities is any other person.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Just opened up a whole new line of business.
Yeah, that's to open the probate. Okay. That doesn't change who is entitled to get the property from the probate. That is creditors, heirs, or devisees, with the Department of State Lands actually falling into the category of heirs.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Darris, is it also possible for a creditor to petition to open a probate?
Yes.
Thank you.
And in insolvent estates, it's not at all rare. Those are the ones who are interested in getting them processed.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative McPherson.
Mr. Darris, to what extent would these problems you've been describing be alleviated if we were to change the law of intestate succession in Oregon so that the more collateral relatives who now have a right to get the property if there's no will, were that they were replaced by the Department of State Lands, that is, the state got property rather than people who are rather distant relations? I'm motivated to ask the question by seeing this reference to collateral relatives living abroad who had no awareness of the existence of their relation who died and yet who have a claim on the property before the state of Oregon lived.
The last session I had a proposal in to narrow heirship. Right now, heirship in Oregon extends to descendants of grandparents, which means first cousins once removed, ordinarily. And there are a number of problems, particularly, you know, with respect to those who make money in these situations by identifying these strangers, because the system for identifying the strangers has gotten very good. We can identify, you know, in the Pew estate that I talked about, within an hour I could identify the 16 aunts and uncles because the English censuses of 1881 and 1901 are available online. And so the system for identifying these strangers has gotten much better. But we've got a system of heirship, you know, that goes back to a time when families were much closer, when you generally grew up in the same town as your cousins and you knew your cousins. I can't, you know, I wouldn't have a hope of identifying most of my cousins. But maybe that's just my family. I don't know. It is a problem. It is not so much the problem that this bill addresses. It's a separate problem. It's a significant problem, in my view. Keep in mind, everybody has the ability to make a will. You know, if you don't like what intestacy does to your estate, you can do a will, leaving your money to your cousins, your, you know, your third cousins twice removed, anybody you want. What heirship is supposed to be is the state's effort to identify what the decedent would have done had the decedent had the foresight to make a will. And because of the changes in our society, I believe that statutory will that we call heirship has slipped out of sync with what the average person wants. There, another great error in that whole statute is that we omit stepchildren. California allows stepchildren to inherit. We don't. And in many families with second marriage situations, and we had an estate larger than $1 million where the closest relative was a stepdaughter. And she didn't get a penny. And in fact, the house in which she grew up went to distant cousins of the decedent, one of whom was literally the laughing heir when I called her to explain to her what she was going to inherit. You know, between laughs was, this isn't a joke, is it? You're not called, you're not. There is a problem in that area in both directions, that heirship in Oregon is over-inclusive, letting in strangers, and under-inclusive, excluding particularly stepchildren who should appropriately get a share, in my view.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might, it really isn't a question, but I recall your proposal from last time, and I have to say that that it resonated with me because of the changes in society and this idea that we provide incentives for an industry that seeks out distant relations who have no connection and have never been in a position to provide any kind of support or assistance to the decedent, and then we cut out, as you say, stepchildren, or we prefer the distant relative over the state of Oregon, which in many cases is providing substantial assistance to our citizens at the end of their lives. That seems deeply troublesome to me. I don't know if this is the vehicle to be trying to go after that set of issues, but I'm certainly open to it, and if you wanted to do it in this context, it'd be would be enthusiastic about a fresh go at it, either in this vehicle or another.
Fine, thank you. Further questions from the committee?
Okay, hearing none, I'm going to conclude the public hearing. And Mr. Darris, with respect to your proposed amendments, I polled the subcommittee and talked to Chair Krieger, and it's our preference that those amendments be submitted on the Senate side. We think it'd be a little more expedient to do it that way. This bill will go before the full committee and then out onto the floor relatively soon, so you can catch the amendments on that side. We'll handle it in concurrence if we have to later on. Okay. I want to give you some directions, so
I'll defer entirely to the chair on procedures.
Okay, we can help you on that. With that, we'll move into the work session on House Bill 2314. And do I have a motion, please, for discussion?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2314 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Flores moves that House Bill 2314 move to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee?
Perhaps Representative Flores will be the carrier on this.
I was going to rely upon her experience in probate and guardianship and conservatorship law. That was my intent, Mr. Representative Guerard. Further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Guerard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2314 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Flores will be the carrier. Thank you. Further business of the committee this morning? Seeing none, then we are adjourned. Thank you.
I feel a little concerned, but for section 1, I think we put in 4.